I'd like to thank the organizers for the opportunity of being here. It's a very wide range workshops. I'm going to talk to you about surface growth and the Burgers equation, rather the Burgers turbulence problem. But there has been in recent years a lot of typical mechanics interest in the one-dimensional version of the Burgers equation. Essentially, it's a very interesting model system for turbulence. It shows strong turbulence even in one dimension, and it's just at the brink of being exactly solvable, and that was all what this excitement was about. That by now that we can, or people can make rather detailed statements about the statistics of shock singularities in 1 plus 1 dimensional Burgers turbulence, and a number of these statements are probably exact. So I'm coming from a slightly different background, namely from the background of the surface growth version of this problem, which is known as the KPZ, or Carver-Parisi-Zhang equation. So I will not probably be able to tell you many details or to add many details to the body of knowledge of the exact result of the 1 plus 1 dimensional turbulence. Rather, I want to ask a different question, a somewhat orthogonal question, namely, are these problems of surface growth, the KPZ equation, and the Burgers equation, are they reasonable field theories? So from the point of view of statistical mechanics, the two system and the wider class of non-equilibrium systems poses considerable challenges as to the consistent field-theoretic formulation of them. Both problems are extended systems, which show some kind of scale invariance. They are both strongly non-equilibrium, and even more importantly, they both share non-perturbative, strong non-perturbative effects that make the application of perturbation theory very difficult. So it's probably fair to say that the status of a field theory of these non-equilibrium systems is still rather fragmentary, and but there are some non-perturbative concepts, among them the operator product expansion, which are probably usable in these systems. And with these methods, I'd like to go into the end. There's some common points between the growth problem and the Burgers turbulence problem. So here's my half a slide introduction into surface growth. For those of you who are not familiar with that, we want to model a surface that grows from an initially flat substrate by the deposition of material, the random deposition of material, here modeled by a spatial-temporal noise that's usually, in the context of surface growth, taken to be short-range correlated in space and time. And then we will, have a macroscopic description, which is a stochastic partial differential equation for height field H of R and T, space and time, that contains a diffusion term that acts to smoothen out local inhomogeneities of the surface. Then initial perturbations will need to grow in a nonlinear way under that for realistic models. So this is a nonlinear term that breaks the up-down symmetry of the surface. So if you look at the surface profile snapshot at a given point in time, you can infer from that the growth velocity, which is unlike for equilibrium crystal surfaces, which have an up-down symmetry. And then there's the noise term that tells us how much material rains under the surface at a given point in space and time. As I said, the noise is usually taken to be short-range correlated. And so this Carver-Parisi-Zhang equation, as it is known in the area of surface growth, is more or less the simplest model that you can write down, which has all these properties. It's stochastic, it's nonlinear, it's directed, that is breaks this up-down symmetry, and it's still a local equation in the sense that the time evolution of the surface depends only on the characteristic of the surface in the neighborhood of that point. That principle may be more questionable for more complicated surfaces that have large overhangs that can shield the material raining down by large overhangs. But here we expect the local mechanism to be a reasonable concept. So here is...
What's the mechanism that prevents the overhangs in this equation? What's the mechanism that prevents the overhangs in this equation?
Well, essentially, this term, the non-linearity is not strong enough to generate overhangs. You can see from the that it leads to a rough surface. That means that the height difference of scale has some power of the longitudinal distances, but that power is smaller than 1. So it's an affine surface, but it's macroscopically flat. So here's the connection to the Burgers equation, which is just given by taking V as the gradient of H. That means in terms of the velocity field, so you have now here the non-linearity, the viscosity term, and the noise term. So the KPZ equation would just be the Hamilton-Jacobi equation for this simple version of turbulence, where you have no pressure, and most of all, most importantly, your singularities are shocks and not water field, because that field is a gradient field of scalar field. But the most important difference is that in the context of turbulence, you usually want to stir the surface on large scales in space at low wavelength. So we take the noise to be long-range correlated in space, and we may still take a short-range correlated in time. That has been a model that has been extensively studied in 1+1 dimensions by several people also here in the audience. And now you can decide which precise form of these long-range correlations you will take, and there has been discussion to which extent this is relevant. I don't want to go into the details here. If you take a long-range correlated noise, that's maybe an analytic function of the relative distance of the two pines, then you get a pattern that is quite different from the surface pattern. It has long, smooth ramps separated by macroscopic shocks, and those are the ones that generate intermittency in the latter case. So if you compare the two problems theoretically, you can make a case that Burgers, the long-range case, is more difficult because it has intermittency, while the surface growth is believed not to have intermittency. In another way, the surface growth problem is more difficult, since the roughness exponent, that means the scaling dimension of the basic field H, is unknown here. It's dynamically generated, while here the dimension of the basic V is known. It's just -1/3. That's the Kolmogorov 1/3. And that tells you just that the third moment of the velocity difference increment increases linearly with the separation. You have no such conservation law here for the short range noise case. And that makes the formal problem also difficult. So, theoretical.
I'm sorry, but, well. And if you formulate Burgers,
yes.
If you will be looking for a scale, from a scale which is bigger than scale of the pumping, you will probably get the first problem.
Oh,
the same problem.
I completely agree. I forgot to mention that this picture is here, and all the work on this shock characteristic, the velocity PDF, is on scales much smaller than the driving length capital R. And there's a second scaling regime that shows this intermittency. Thank you for pointing it out. If you go on scales much larger than the driving length R, you're back.
Why is scaling of velocity field responsible?
Well, it will turn out to be that way, in the sense that we Well, let me come to this problem later when I discuss it in particular. Let me, because I want to first address the other problem, the short-range noise, and it has been, people have tried to study this problem by perturbation theory, that means by by the renormalization group, or which has in fact been applied to three different scenarios. The Burgers, historically refers to the formulation as a Burgers equation in terms of the velocity field V. Then for the height equation, the KPV equation, and to the third formulation, which is the directed polymer in a random medium, and these directed polymers are, in the language of the Burgers equation, just the minimizers of the reaction. Now, people have done this perturbation theory in all three problems. Actually, I should mention that the directed polymer is one ramification of this problem that makes it interesting now to a completely different community that has to do with the comparison of biological sequences that enters through into this problem through the formulation as a problem of directed polymers in a random medium. I don't want to get into this for time constraints, but if anybody is interested in discussing why computational biologists are now getting interested in the Burgers equation, I'm happy to do this after the talk. So here is field theory in terms of perturbation theory that people have done in all three formulations, and the qualitative picture for this short-range noise case is now pretty clear from all of this work. In low dimension, a small non-linearity or small amount of disorder for the polymer is a relevant perturbation, so it drives the system to a strong coupling fixed point, while in dimensions larger than 2, in 2 dimensions the problem is isotropically free, and in dimensions larger than 2 you need a finite amount of disorder or a finite amount of non-linearity to drive you to the strong coupling regime, while a small amount of non-linearity will make the system isotropically linear. And what I've shown a while ago is that this system is in fact one loop renormalizable. And that means that there is a renormalization group scheme where the flow of this effective coupling constant has exactly a quadratic form. Now, the good news about this is that you usually have no difficulty finding out the zeros of the quadratic equation, and you get precisely one non-trivial fixed point. And you can work out the properties at that fixed point exactly. We have an exact perturbative renormalization group equation. And but it turns out that the physical this fixed point corresponds to the reference position. So the bad news about this one loop renormalizability is that you at no point at no order in perturbation theory will you find any other fixed point then this fixed point, in particular the strong coupling regime, is unacceptable to any order of perturbation theory. And that's what makes this problem difficult, like a number of other strong coupling problems in statistical mechanics, and what calls for non-perturbative methods. And that's what I want to talk about for the remainder of the talk. Oh yes, I should have mentioned that. There's a discussion as to how far this transition goes, in particular what happens to the strong coupling regime in large dimensions, whether the transition might become first order. That question is not yet resolved. So in numerical work, people seem to favor the existence of no up critical dimension, that means non-trivial strong coupling exponents even in higher dimensions, although that work is rather limited in its in the available system sizes, while there are theoretical arguments that favor an upper critical dimension around 4.
The simulation thing is solid, right? And they feel both as well in the same thing as the class.
Yes, so there's a whole set of questions really concerned with the numerics, and we'll come back to the numerics when I later compare the presumably exact results. I think the numerics on this problem is, as a whole, difficult to do. So I don't expect much to come out in terms of decisive statements in terms of the numerics in the foreseeable future. The specific is rather hard for this problem numerically. So let us try to look at what we can say non-perturbatively about this problem. And so let's go in a formulation that is appropriate for working directly in the strong coupling limit. And that's very, so if you come from the point of view of turbulence, that's a very natural thing to do. So we work in a renormalized frame. I don't want to go into technical details, such that the correlation functions have a finite limit as the viscosity goes to zero. And in fact, we know that the viscosity is a formally irrelevant perturbation of this implicit scaling regime, that means it scales with a positive power of the ultraviolet cutoff, of the short distance cutoff, which in turbulence we think of as the dissipation length, beyond which on smaller scale dissipation effect becomes dominant. So, the important thing from the point of abstract point of view of scaling, without now sort of forget the equation now, just ask how scaling manifests itself, is that it manifests itself really in two conceptually different ways. We could first look at the single point quantity. So we take here, in terms of our height formulation, the height minus the average height at one given point in space, and ask about its probability distribution function. We ask the same question for the velocity minus the average velocity in the Burgers formulation. And then if the system is properly renormalized, means the ultraviolet cutoff does not enter this formulation, a probability distribution of an appropriately scaled variable. And that means that all the moments, the case moments of the height, the relative height, scales with the large distance length, which would, in the case of the KPZ equation, would be just the system size, or in case of long-range driving, will be the driving length, capital R, which I denote by the same letter, times and some to the power of some scaling exponent of the X field multiplied by K. So there's gap scaling of these single point moments of the height difference. The second sort of set of quantities we can look at is height differences between two different points on the surface. And so there's now a second length, namely the distance between these two points, R1 minus R2, and I call the height distance delta H. And so we have in our scaling function a second dimensionless quantity, which is the ratio of the distance between the two points to that to the large distance cutoff. And that means that the kth moment of the height difference can scale in a different way. It can trade a power of the relative distance with a power of the infrared length. So we have now the possibility that the kth moment scales in a that all these moments each scale in k-dependent ways, and we call that multi-scaling, and xk tilde, the k multi-scaling is going for this height difference. Now, I want to make now an assumption, and that assumption which will come along a bit later, is that the height field behaves like a reasonable field in a field theory, and that means it obeys an operator product expansion. Now, an operator product expansion is a fancy word for a rather simple concept, and that simple concept means that as you bring height fields, two or more of them, together, say on the scale of the, close together, much closer than any other distances, then this object of several height fields in the vicinity of each other behaves like a sum of operators of fields in our theory at one point, say the midpoint of these points, or just the point R1. So this product of operators is written as a sum of single point operators times an appropriate power of the relative distance scale, which follows from power counting. So this is the difference in scaling dimension between this object and this object that makes this here, times the dimension of scaling function that gives you the shape, how these points are brought together. So for 2 points, this would just be a Q number. That's the assumption. Okay, now you can say, well, even if I swallow that assumption, what do I learn from it? Just putting in an operator product, it's an extension, does it tell me anything about the system? But what's the physical content of putting it in? Now, you can see there's one obvious consequence already, is that it relates, this concept relates these two versions of scale. Namely, I can cook now down these height differences to operators at a single point. And therefore, the large distance singularities in here are coming from the dependence on the large distance cutoff of these operators in here. These other prefactors don't contain any dependence on the large distance cutoff. So therefore, taken to be local quantity, this local fusing of operator products can take place, and therefore I can any product of operators, say the product that occur in here, I can decompose into such operators at one point, and those single point functions coming from up here are the only way how the large cutoff can end. And a second point I would like to make at this point, and that's maybe not surprising to you if you think in terms of turbulence, but it is a very strong point for the people working in surface growth, and that is that intermittency is really generic in these models. So as soon as you have a rough and not an interacting field theory with negative dimensional scaling field, as it is with height field over here, that means scaling field whose correlation function increase with the spatial distance, such as the height difference to some power increase with the separation of the 2 points. As soon as you have negative dimensional scaling fields in an interacting field theory, you should expect multi-scaling. And why is that so? Because if you have these height fields over here, and they couple to negative dimensional scaling operators, like these k power of the height over here, and if you take the gradient of this, then also these gradient heights will couple to the same operators, and that will mean that height differences will also pick up a dependency of the interact. So,
it's a trivial confusion. What do you mean by scale transformation to a single point? What is kept fixed, and what is being scaled? So why is the height dependent on scale? Right? This is the height average at a single point.
That is.
There is no coarse graining of any sort. Right?
No, I'm not talking here about the scale transformation, but just of scaling in the strong coupling regime. So what I mean here is if you have your surface growth in a system of size R, so you grow from a flat surface, then you will get bigger and bigger mountains, up to a size, so these moments measure the typical size of the largest mountains and largest valleys of the surface. And they, so this typical delta H will scale with R to some power pi. So that means if I make R bigger, now you get bigger.
R is the size of the system. And the forcing, the small scale forcing is being fixed.
The small scale forcing is being fixed. In the Burgess case, we would say R is the driving thing. So at constant epsilon, at constant energy, right, and at constant viscosity, if I make the driving length bigger, I will also get bigger bigger mean deviation of the velocity from the
center. So what is exactly being L6 in that case?
It is also the prefactor of the driving, the epsilon, and the energy flux, and the viscosity is L6. And then if I make the driving length bigger, then the velocity is average the typical deviation of the point velocity from the average velocity, which is the average velocity can by Galilean invariance take any value, but the typical velocity fluctuation will scale with the one-third power of the driving length. And that's the one-third that is I'm referred to. Now, in KPZ, in the short-range problem, now there's a further assumption that I'm going to make, but that is very well tested numerically. The striking feature of the KPZ equation is that we seem to have no intermittency. But that's tacitly assumed by most people working in surface flows, and in this kind of surface flow problem, you don't have intermittency. But from what we have just seen from a general theoretic framework, you should actually, as soon as you have negative dimensional scaling fields and interactions, you should expect that also height differences would couple to the large distance.
Why do you have to have intermittency? In 1D, there is a fluctuation dissipation theorem there.
In 1D, you can prove it through the fluctuation dissipation theorem. There's no intermittency. In two dimension, there's also people have. There's no proof or anything, but people have not found, have looked carefully for intermittency and have not found it. So let's take this as a second input that we assume that this is indeed true, and the KPZ problem, also in two dimensions, does not possess intermittency. It preserves that very special feature. You don't have intermittency even in two dimensions. And that would mean that the case moment of the height difference between two points would scale with the separation of the top point to the minus k times x. So all the intermittency exponents are zero, and that means that all the gradient of height do not couple to negative dimensional fields. If they were gradient of height, is equivalent to saying height differences between close by points, because you can write the height difference as an integral over the gradient from R1 to R2. So height differences don't acquire a dependence on the infrared on the system size capital R. It's equivalent to say that these fields do not couple to negative dimensional. Now, if you go back to this operator product expansion, then you can see, without going into any details, that this requires a rather special form of the of this operator product expansion. And if you take the gradient, then all the couplings to these negative dimensional fields have to vanish. Now, in a generic case, this is not the case. If you have an equation like this, and if you take n gradient, you can apply these n gradients to the coefficient function, but here the dependence on the system size will remain there. So the only way of getting this is actually that this prefactor is a polynomial in R, so that the gradient will kill this polynomial. And that tells you that the precisely the scaling dimension of all these operators that are allowed to occur in the scaling dimension. So I'm saying, this is just to emphasize the same point again, the absence of intermittency from the point of view of the field theory is a very strong statement and makes it very non-generic. And in fact, what it tells you is that if you have k height units, then these operators that are allowed here on the right-hand side all have to have a scaling dimension which has the form k times the scaling dimension of the height field plus n. N is the order of that polynomial, which is over here. And that is roughly, these fields are then of the form, so the n gradients apply to k powers of h, which several sort of ways of applying the algorithm to these n powers. So the fact that we can count these dimensions in this linear way would normally occur only in a linear model, like in the Gaussian field theory. We would count dimensions that way. Just for each gradient, we take one unit, and for each power of the field, we add one value of xh. So in this sense, although it's a strongly interacting field theory, it behaves like a Gaussian theory. That is what makes this thing so special. So where were we? Okay. Now, I want to just give you a flavor of how strong this relation is. And it is so strong that it even fixes the scaling score of the height. Now here is, in the stationary growth space, we are in here, the surface grows with a stationary ensemble of heights and values. I want to use the equation of motion to derive a relationship between the normalized correlation function, which is standard procedure in field theory. So here I have a correlation function with k powers of h at one point. I'm just focusing on one point, so there are other points, and this correlation function is represented by this dot. I have a stationarity equation, which essentially just means that I insert here this letter j, just means that I insert the right hand of the equation of motion for this object. Now, what is the right hand side of the equation of motion? Say if this h to the k is here represented by h to the 4th, so I have 4 operators of h at one point. I insert the equation of motion, I essentially use the chain rule for each of these guys. So I have one term where on the right hand side I have the orientation term, the nonlinear term, and I have the noise term. And of course, this is a renormalized equation of motion, so all singularities of things that become infinite if the ultraviolet cutoff goes to zero. I should say, in order to deep this properly, I have to point split these objects and then let the ultraviolet cutoff go to zero in a well-defined way. And so if I do this, then all the singular terms have to cancel because we're talking about a finite equation for a finite normalized perturbation correlation function. And all the terms that have a positive power of the cutoff, if the cutoff goes to zero, you throw away because they go to zero. So in this way, so this mu has a positive power of the cutoff. I should say that so the noise term, since the noise is short-range correlated, creates only a strong singularity that can be shown to cancel with a singular term of this diffusion term. So we are left with a in this limit with a finite equation that seems to invoke only the term with the nonlinearity, because this term is again the prefactor, is irrelevant in a sense of scaling, so it carries a positive power of the short distance length. And but so if you imagine this to be true for a second, so this terms, next terms would be absent, then you would get from if you run this argument more carefully through, you will get a relationship between correlation functions that equates an object like this with zero on the right hand side. Now what does this mean physically? So this is the kth power of the height difference between two points times the mean square slope of the height at a given point. So that's a reasonably not the simplest object, but a reasonably simple object. And what if this is zero, then what would it mean? It would mean that essentially the statistics of slope would be coupled from the relative height. So we wouldn't know here. Here, say on a Gaussian surface, if you are if you know the slope at a given point, you don't know whether you are high up on a mountain or deep down in a valley. Because the surface is up-down, symmetric. The KPZ surface, actually, is not supposed to be up-down, symmetric. So I'm not... Let me do... this is really a cartoon of this surface, but it's not... You don't have such a strong asymmetry. But if it were so such that the valleys are rather deep and the hilltops are rounded, then by telling you the slope of the surface, you could tell whether you are deep down in the valley or up on the hill. So if you are a hiker in fog and you have a surface like that and it's steep, then you guess that you are in a valley. And if it's not steep, you guess you are on the hilltop. On a surface, on a Gaussian surface, this doesn't help the location. So if this is zero, it's actually something that we think is unphysical, because you should actually have a coupling between relative height, so if this point R1 is deeper down than other points R2, and the statistic of the slope. Now, the only way of getting this thing to be non-zero is, in fact, that we concede having made a logical mistake. And this logical mistake was, we said, well, there are negative powers of the small distance cutoff of the viscosity that go to infinity, and those terms have to cancel, and there are positive powers, and those terms go to zero. What if a term has exactly the power a to the zero? And that can happen if this positive power that makes this coupling constant irrelevant is precisely offset by a singularity of the corresponding diagram. And here, in this case, due to the absence of intermittency in the set of arguments that I've tried to show you before, we know precisely all the singularities of the diagram that this can have. So these are known, because these are given by the operator product, and these are nothing but all things that fuse closely together. And we know in this case what the possible divergences are. They are powers of the ultraviolet cutoff, and here is what they are. So in order to have a term different from zero here, requires one term in this series to be of the power a to the zero, which is of order one, if the ultraviolet cutoff goes to zero. And that gives you a quantization rule for the possible scaling exponent of the height field. And, well, it turns out in order for this to be non-zero, K0 has to be an odd integer. And so in D equals 1 plus 1, we know exactly by the subtraction dissipation theory that the roughness exponent, this is minus a half, so this will be 2 over 4 in dimension 2. And so the next reasonable integers to insert here would be K0 3, that makes it 2 over 5. And that's a value very close to the numerical value for the roughness of the surface in two dimensions. As I said, there are there's a separate discussion on this numerics, so maybe we should defer to
later. You see how you get from, you have an equation for the product.
Yeah.
Is it easy to, the next line, you have the difference, the power of difference. Yes. Is it easy to see how the difference arises from the product?
Well, I mean, essentially, the way to think about it is that this is a combination of products, each of which I can write in this way. So,
can you really do it?
Yes, I mean, these are two spatially distinct points. Yeah. So we're talking here about either sort of products where two fields are at one point, or all the fields are different.
But if I put all points the same in the first equation?
Well, here, I mean, this is in the first equation, so this would be one of these points, so let me put this equal to R1.
Yeah.
And then so K can equal 1 or 2, that would correspond to the two possible terms if I multiply this product out. And there are other terms, like here, the point R2 would be a separate point whose contributions would be are here represented by dots. So that is the second.
If 1 is equal to 2, You do not have zero in the first line, and you have zero in the next one, in the last one.
But it's a two-point... Right, you can, in fact, also apply this to single point things, but maybe this is a technical point because my time is limited, so I should briefly tell you what happens in a context where intermittency does take place. And there we can try and use the same technique. And so here is again my velocity field now, which has sort of two length scales, the mean separation between shocks and the width of the shock, which is given by this viscosity, and the mean size of the shocks we scale, like r to the power 1/3. And now we have to introduce a set of fields that represent these shocks. So I claim that we have to supplement our operator product algebra by fields that live on these shocks. And that's because the gradients, the power of gradients, are actually quite different whether you are on the shocks or away from the shocks. So this is the case moment, the case power of the gradient at shocks, and we know how this scales. This scales with sort of velocity difference, typical width, the typical size of the shock, divided by its width to the power k, times the probability of finding a shock at the point r, and that's the shock width divided by the mean separation of the shock. And that just gives you the scale with the large distance length, and we have a characteristic response. So that's elementary. And now we write down an operator product expansion that couples k field to a shock. So that means if I have k field, I can have shock in between. Now, I want to show you that this operator product expansion makes sense, or why this makes sense. The first thing we can check is it gives the correct multiscale. Of course, with the Burgers equation, we know what the correct multiscale is, because we know that if we have two points in space, the dominant contribution of the case velocity difference moment will come for k larger positive integer. It's just given by the fact that you have a shock, a configuration with a shock in between them. So it's proportional to the distance between the two points. So all these moments are called scale linearly with a distance, and then with an appropriate power of the system size that absorbs the rest of the scaling dimension of the object on the left hand side. And as you can see here, if I plug this in, then this the dimension of this field gives you precisely the right scaling dimension. The second thing we can try is to play again to ask if there are dynamical anomalies. That means, again, terms where the viscosity which vanishes as the power vanishes with the short distance cutoff, and divergency just cancel. And here, that is the basic message of Polyakov's paper on Chokin, that such cancellations must exist. Now we can see that these cancellations are given in terms of this operator product expansion. Polyakov didn't use an operator product expansion to consider this kind of singularity, but we can see this kind of operator product expansion actually gives you the right singularity. So how does this go? The time derivative of the kth moment, now we take here the single point deviation of the velocity minus the average, is again a bunch of terms. There's a driving term, and then there is the viscosity term. And in fact, the nonlinear term drops out for the single point moment, since it's a gradient term. So there has to be a balance between this viscosity term with this vanishing prefactor and the finite driving term. So that now we see very explicitly that the same mechanism has to operate, namely that this finite term has to be offset by a product of a vanishing term, mu, times a diverging diagram. And in fact, since these objects coupled to this shock field, we can check that this coupling in the operator product term gives us precisely the right power so that this cancellation can take place. And the interesting thing is, from sort of the point of view of the generalization of the other systems, is that this kind of this dynamically anomaly links the intermittency exponent, that means the shock field Sk, the scaling dimension of the shock field, with the scaling dimension of the powers of the velocity. So there is now a scaling relation that fixes the intermittent exponent in terms of non-exponent of the powers of the velocity. Now, if that were to be generalizable to other theories of turbulence, it would be an interesting way to get information about multi-scaling, but that's not yet known.
The station here actually different from your conventional crystal quantum estimation in the sense that like there, as long as measurement points we correlate are non-coincident, the scaling is just a trivial superposition of the cubic polynomials.
Yes.
So you actually are doing something extra. You're introducing an extra additional field per order of the correlator.
But I'm saying that that if I want to have intermittency, there should be a negative dimensional field that just corresponds to the intermittency exponent that are observed in each moment of the velocity, the kth moment of the velocity is different. It defines in an intermittent context a new scaling exponent for each order of the moment.
But this is coming in completely by hand, and you know what scaling for S to put in there because you know about shocks and so
yes.
How can I calculate what scaling of SK is if I didn't have that brilliant insight?
Well, I mean, for this system, the intermittency exponents, as you say, are sort of trivial. They are known because of this simple thing that you have these shock singularities, and we know that the main contributions to this case moment are just coming from these single shock terms, and that gives you.
So there's nothing
to be sort of. This is a trivial calculation, and all I'm saying is there is a well-defined family of local fields that give you precisely the right scaling of these numbers. Now, in a more general context, there could be still fields corresponding to singularities, say, in another source, especially if you take vortex filaments, things like that.
Wait, operators like that. Take half the scalar, and there are no singularities, and we know that there's a normal scaling, et cetera. So, is there another way of doing the passive scale? Right, but these intermittent exponents are non-trivial.
Yeah.
So the question is, can I use these ideas to redo the passive scale calculation and get the known answer there?
Well, the short answer is I don't know. I haven't thought about passive scale from that point of view. I think if there is a problem, any problem which has intermittency should have the appropriate sort of negative dimensional operator that corresponds to these intermittency exponents.
But that's the definition, right?
Yeah.
You take the n for the correlator and you say that it's an operator.
This is a local object. So here I can go on a shock and compute something that is a shock characteristic. On the other hand, this is an object of the link several points. And now the question is how these extended objects, the correlation function, are linked to the single point quantities. And all I'm saying, I guess, it's sort of what I'm saying is maybe a little bit trivial in this context because the numbers are all known. There's nothing to, this is a said to the calculation. What I'm saying is that there are local fields that do the job. So the known structure of shocks and two-point functions is consistent with an operator product extension like that. By the way, it's a quite different operator product extension than Polyakov wrote down.
So,
and
I don't understand is there another definition of that SK field other than the left-hand side? Other than an object with scales as this multi-point correlator?
Yes, I mean, this, if you take...
Wait.
One shot.
This is something that that you pulled out of the hat. But suppose you never knew about shock. Suppose you were doing a passive scaling calculation. And of course, these days we're also thinking of that in terms of some friends, et cetera, et cetera. But mathematically, does this object have some other definition that I can start trying to write down an equation for it? If we can write down an equation for the multipoint correlator, what sort of local object can one?
Well, I think
if
gradient is a local object, so we can say, well, take the two points that are arbitrarily close together, and that gives you sort of the statistics of gradient. So the gradients are taken as local objects. Of course, the definition of the gradient is a limit to points.
So this is now a general definition and not just. The shock inside. So for passive scalar, I should write down the gradient of the scalar to the kth power and start trying to calculate.
You can think of this certainly as a more general object than for Burgers. Now, I'm not claiming that these objects are always the right for any objects for any type of sequence of circuits. So, first of all, if you have higher dimensions, then it's a non-trivial thing, whether you take the longitudinal distance. This is a tensorial object, different representation can transform very differently. And then I'm only saying there should be local fields, such of which this is an example, I should just maybe briefly say what Polyakov did, is he wrote down an operator product. But on the right-hand side, you have only powers of V. Of course, you have also here omitted a bunch of terms. Did you notice only the leading Galilean variant term, which is the shock term? Polyakov's OPE, there's only powers of V and gradients of powers of V. In fact, he uses still a little bit different formulation in terms of generating fields, which are sort of exponentials of B that then generate these terms. There are no terms explicitly representing the shock field. And it turns out that this operator product extension is then probably inconsistent with the most with what we know now about the precise properties of the tail of the probability distribution function in 1 plus 1 dimension. And I claim this comes from the fact that it does not take into account the singular configuration explicitly. Namely, if you think now of gradients of the velocity, there are really two different scaling fields that correspond to this object gradient V to the power K. Namely, one object that sits on the ramps where these gradients scale differently, and another object that sits on the shocks. So this object, gradient V to the power K, found in fact two different scaling fields. And they should be taken into account in the OPE explicitly in order to make it compatible.
So when you calculate the PDF in this OPE, you get -7.5.
Well, that's a good question. Maybe the short answer is it's not clear how this term is precisely determined by the OPE. But what I'm saying is consistent with this form of the OPE. But it admits that it's consistent with the known that both tails, the left and the right tail of the OPE. No, I cannot calculate the minus 3.5 or whatever is the current exponent on Vogue. But I'm saying that Polyakov's OP is inconsistent with this whole picture because you can't fit the right tail and the left tail with the same OP.
What?
What?
What are you talking about? You have an equation, you solve it,
yes.
And you produce the entire PDF from right to left, or from left to right, whatever you choose.
Well, I don't think so, but maybe that's...
No, we did it many times, and Walter did it many times.
I'm already over time, so just let me finish 2 minutes, and then we...